This is Building Bridges with Ken Nash and Mimi Rosenberg. Welcome home, Delbert, Africa.
Delbert walks. For Delbert, Africa, a member of the MOVE organization, his imprisonment for his membership in MOVE has led to what the late Nelson Mandela called a long walk to freedom. On August 8, 1978, Delbert was beaten brutally, senseless. His jawbone was broken. To make matters worse and to add insult to injury, when several cops were prosecuted for this vicious, brutal beating of Delbert, a Philadelphia judge would willy-nilly dismiss everything, all of the charges, and he dismissed the jury, which was imported from a Pennsylvania county, one of the whitest rural counties in the state, and issue an acquittal despite videotape evidence. The judge, incredibly, writes an opinion that justifies Delbert's beating by citing to his muscularity, I kid you not. For Delbert was apparently well built, and the poor cops were frightened that he had so much musculature. Shortly after this beating occurred, and was denied by police at a press conference later that day in City Hall, it was broadcast all across the city of Philadelphia. At a public meeting in Center City a few days later, a popular black politician, the late city councilman Lucien Blackwell, told a crowd of blacks that, this is a direct quote, "Delbert Africa is one of the greatest black men who have ever lived." I'm told that Delbert's beating can be seen today on YouTube, so check it out. Today, Delbert Africa is free after 42 years in the joint. He is free to tell his own story now from imprisoned nation. This is Mumia Abu-Jamal. These commentaries are recorded by Noel Hanrahan of Prison Radio.
With that spectacular voice and spirit and energy of the people's journalist, Mumia Abu-Jamal, we too welcome home, Delbert Africa. It is really an honor to have you with us.
I appreciate that, and I love hearing Mumia's voice again, which is the first time I've heard that voice in a long, long time. And I love what he had to say, because he always was a putter out of truth. He would tell it like it is.
And also with us is Brad Thompson, a lawyer with the People's Law Office in Chicago, which has long distinguished itself as a representative of people who are indeed seeking equal rights and justice. Brad, thank you for joining us.
I am really honored to be here with you and Delbert.
Why don't we begin with yourself? The issue of the legal case against Delbert Africa and the travesty that was perpetrated and keeping him behind the walls, encaged for 42 years. Your thoughts, your perspective, and your understanding of what it means to be a political prisoner for those still in doubt that this country holds people on a political basis.
Delbert's case, as a member of the MOVE 9, really does demonstrate a lot of the injustices that are inherent in the legal system, and particularly shows how the tools of the state are used against communities of color and poor people, especially communities that organize and assert their own rights. With the MOVE organization, because they represent all of that, an organization that has stood up to state power, they've really faced extreme state repression. The history of the state repression is astounding. Not only Delbert and the other members of the MOVE 9 in 1978, where they were in their home, what began as a dispute over very minor ordinance violations turned into a massive raid on their home that they shot thousands of rounds of bullets into the house, pulled out everyone in the house, and beat Delbert after Delbert was shot. Other people were shot. Then railroaded them through the legal system, and 9 MOVE members went to prison. Delbert, along with 6 others, have now been released on parole. Tragically, Merle Africa and Phil Africa died in prison. It's really important to look at how these cases, like the MOVE 9, where, or like Mumia, who we heard from earlier, where the underlying case and the underlying identity, the political identity of the individuals is used to further criminalize them at their trial. And we see that throughout the case of the MOVE 9. And then we very tragically see that later in 1985 when on May 13th, the police dropped a bomb on the MOVE house, killing 11 people, including children. So I think that it's important to look at that history and contextualize that as not as an outlier of what the system does, but as the epitomization of what state power does, especially to those communities that organize and take action to assert their rights and to fight against oppression and injustice.
Delbert, take us back to that terrible date, the anniversary of which is coming up in May. Give us more of a sense of who the MOVE organization was and the commitment which you and I were speaking about the other day, that MOVE, among other things that it championed, was an organization that was far ahead of its time and sensitive to the planet, issues of ecology, years and years before it has become championed by particularly the young people in the world community. So give us a sense of who MOVE was and why it posited such a perceived threat to the establishment of Philadelphia.
The MOVE organization was founded by our legendary John Africa. John Africa welded together a group of people, not just black folks, although there was a lot of black folks there. We had Latinos, Filipinos, Caucasians, everybody. The power of John Africa's teaching brought all these diverse people together to realize that this earth was our earth. And if we wanted to protect our earth, we had to get on that revolutionary road, protect life. During the early days when we would demonstrate against the circus and people would laugh at us, oh man, this is the circus. And here it is years later, now people are beginning to realize the viciousness of trained, domesticated animals in the circuses. And there are more demonstrations. But John Africa started us way back in the early 70s. We would demonstrate against the zoos. We would demonstrate against all forms of oppression that we saw. And what happened during the early days, Frank Rizzo, a brutal mayor of Philadelphia, had his overblown, vicious, racist cops, whom the black community didn't respect and feared they could get away with anything. And so, in fighting that oppression, John Africa told us, look, we got to start telling people how vicious these people are. So we started demonstrating against the cops. They were so upset that this group would demonstrate against them and their brutality that peaceful demonstrations turned into melees where they was like beating us, stomping us. Every time we go to court, we tell the judge, no, we don't respect you. No, we ain't standing up for you. Your system is corrupt, everything about it. and we get arrested there until finally in 1977, the Philadelphia police had issued some phony warrants about house violations and threatened to come out to the house. We had four members that were in prison at the time. And we said, look, the only way we're going to come out of this is we got to get our people home. So we mounted a demonstration on a platform of our house, and we demanded that our members be sent home before this thing would end. That led into over a year-long blockade where Frank Rizzo started us out. He knowingly said, okay, don't want to come out, I won't feed them. He did everything he could to drive us out. Finally, got a Judge DeBona to issue some phony warrants in August 1978 that all the members named in those warrants should be put under arrest because they refused to leave the house. The members he named were all the known members of MOVE. We had people in Richmond, Virginia, in our Seeds of Wisdom chapter, taking care of children. They never were in the house. Rhonda and Gail Africa were down there, and they were arrested. The rest of us, John Africa told us, this is going to come to a head. You, the city of Philadelphia, are going to do something to make the whole world understand that MOVE will not be oppressed, will not be pushed. So he asked, did we want to stay in the house, and who didn't? People gathered in the house. I think it was the August 2nd, Judge DeBona issued warrants, told the police, gave them the legality to arrest us. On August 8th, the house was surrounded by hundreds of cops. They gave a warning, come on out, or we coming in to get you. And we refused because we told them, people are vicious killers. You done murdered our babies in your women's stomach. You done beat us to death. No, we ain't coming out. So we took refuge in our basement. They brought in a bulldozer, knocked down the fence, and in the rubble of the fence, that we had animals out in the yard. Myself and two other members, Eddie and Phil, came out in full view of the cops who were only yards away from us, obviously unarmed, and began to clear away the rubble to save the animals. They never bothered about trying to arrest us because they were intent on killing us. Then we retreated back into the basement with the rest of the family. A few moments later, around 8 o'clock, we heard shots. And this was after the water had been put on us from water cannons. We were in water that was waist and chest deep, trying to save babies and animals and keep ourselves afloat. When the gunshots began, there was just a stream of bullets. They were trying to kill everybody in there. One cop, I remember his name, Robert Hurst, he bragged about it at trial later how he saw a group of women and children, and he emptied his carbine at them. When asked, were they armed? He said no, but he was trained to eliminate the possible oppression from women and children from his Vietnam experience. So that's the thing we went through. They put gas on us, anti-personnel gas, tear gas and all that. People couldn't breathe. And that's when we began evacuating the basement to try and, you know, keep everybody safe. I was in the back of the basement directing people out. As I began to go out, a cop on the side of the house put a gun to my head and told me, bring my black ass out here. I did. I was shirtless because earlier I had taken a shot in the chest, a shotgun pellet, and had taken my shirt off. And when I came out the house, I saw two cops, one with a helmet in his hand, another with a shotgun in his hand. And they kept motioning me over there. So as I walked toward them, I'm looking at the guy with the shotgun. Before I knew it, the guy with the steel helmet had cracked me on one side of my face, fractured my orbital bone, broke my jaw, and instantaneously the dude with the shotgun gave me a butt stroke, broke the other side of my jaw. I can remember feeling, man, this is crazy. But I was out. I didn't have any motor skills at all. And then some cop pulled me by my hair down the street. I'm obviously unarmed. Other cops began to beat and stomp on me. They were just trying to kill me. They drug me across the street where the police commissioner, Ron O'Neill, and Inspector George Fensel was standing there, and another cop they had Phil Africa down on the ground against the police car, and this one cop slapped Phil. And Phil, you know, he rocked his head. He looked up at me and he said, "We gonna be all right." And that brought me a spark of light. And I gave him, I said, "That's right, don't move." And before they separated me, I heard the police commissioner tell other cop, "That's enough of that, because we got too many cameras on us." Took me to the hospital. Some medic or whoever it was dug the shotgun pellet out of my chest with his hand. He took me down to the police station. All the other people in the neighborhood that were protesting this attack, they were attacked and viciously beaten by the police. When I got down, the first time they took me over to the side and they began, "Move, yeah, come on, move." And the police got so excited, they said, "Oh, no, we better not put them there." So they took me back around to where my move brothers was and put me in there. Everybody that was taken out the house was stripped, given gunshot residue tests. None of us had any gunshot residue on us. They had reporters who were at the scene who testified how shots came from behind them as they were facing the house from across the street. It's well known that you don't give nine black folks 30 to 100 year sentences, a third degree murder for killing a white police officer. They never had any evidence of any first or second degree, which would have given us life. So they just trumped up charges. They had one cop that was grazed by the finger. He said the graze was a bullet wound. And we've given 5 years for that. They added on a bunch of stuff, and all nine of the committed MOVE members were given 30 to 100-year sentences because the judge said, "Since you want to act as a family, I'm going to sentence you as a family."
Delbert, let me bring Brad back into the picture now. And Brad Thompson, tell us a little bit about the trial specifically relevant to Delbert Africa and how the state was able to keep Delbert incarcerated for 42 years.
All nine members ended up receiving the same sentence of 30 to 100 years. The evidence that they used was primarily based on their activity previous to August 8, 1978. It wasn't physical evidence. There were cameras there documenting the footage captured was the physical beating of Delbert by the police officers. Those officers were actually criminally charged and were acquitted by a judge. However, the MOVE 9 went on trial and really were legally railroaded. It's really shocking from a legal perspective. For example, the evidence was physically destroyed at the scene. They brought in bulldozers and they had hoses from fire trucks. The water soaked up the whole house and then they completely demolished the house and even the trees surrounding the house that would have reflected the trajectory of the bullets. There's an example where at the trial, the prosecutor, quote-unquote, corrected the medical examiner's report in terms of the trajectory of the bullet of the officer who died. Really remarkably, from a lawyer's perspective, all the MOVE 9 chose to exercise their constitutional rights to represent themselves in court. And as part of that, they were then given what's called backup counsel, where there's attorneys who are there to support them to be able to answer any questions. But the right of representing yourself is a constitutional right that they were exercising and wishing to do on their own. However, the judge removed all of the MOVE 9 from the courtroom, denied them the right to represent themselves, and had standby counsel, this backup counsel, as representing them in their absence and against the wishes of the MOVE 9. These are also attorneys who were not prepared to try the case. The judge on the case sentenced all of them to the same 30 to 100 year sentence. That means that they were eligible for parole starting in 2008. Every year that they went up for parole, they would repeatedly be denied for the same boilerplate reasons. And those included lack of remorse, lack of responsibility. That put them in a really impossible position because the only factual basis to support their convictions was the fact that they were in the house. Any other information that the MOVE 9 would be mentioning during the parole hearings would be considered, quote, denial of responsibility, lack of acceptance of responsibility, and lack of remorse. So I, along with Brett Grody, another attorney who is with the Abolitionist Law Center out of Pittsburgh, began representing the Move 9 in their parole hearings in 2018. What we did was compile what everybody had been doing inside over all these years. You know, Delbert and the other members of the Move 9 had really been demonstrating remarkable humanity throughout the prisons that they were incarcerated in. So we were able to get letters of support from former prisoners who described the way that the Move 9 really shaped their individual lives and mentored them, minimized violence on the inside. We were able to get letters from retired DOC prison staff describing how remarkable they were individually. Because of that leadership from the Move 9 and what they were doing on the inside over all these years, and all the broad community support that the Move 9 had, and all the sort of political organizing pressure that had been built over all these years, we were able to push to start getting the parole board to grant release to some of the Move 9. So beginning in June of 2018, Debbie Africa was the first of the Move 9 to be released. She was followed by Mike and Janet, Janine, and Eddie. And then Delbert was released in January. And then at the beginning of February, Chuck, the last surviving member of the Move 9, was finally released as well. So that comes out to 42 years where they had a 30 to 100-year sentence. Again, really based on evidence that shows it was politically motivated in the sense that prior altercations with the police were granted as a sense of evidence of a conspiracy that would have started years prior of conspiring to confront the police in this instance that was initiated by the police on August 8th. It really demonstrated the underlying basis was not about any crime that had occurred that day, but really about what MOVE represented in their community at that time and for years prior.
I always have to catch my breath, and I remember that for, I believe, at least 6 years, Delbert Africa was in a notorious solitary confinement wing known by prisoners as the Dungeon. He went through this incredible period of isolation, and then in 1985, when Delbert Africa had been in prison for almost 7 years, tragedy struck even further when he learned that Philadelphia police had conducted a second siege on the MOVE communal home, and there they dropped the incendiary bomb from a helicopter that ignited a fire that spread over the overwhelmingly African-American neighborhood. 61 houses were razed, 11 people in the MOVE house were killed, including 5 children. Delbert Africa, you have a sense of warmth and love and humanity that almost defies understanding. How were you able to fortify yourself in the experience of nothing short of absolute hell, 42 years behind the walls, thoroughly, unjustly, and viciously treated all the while?
The teachings of John Africa, that's what kept me going. People talk about exercise, activism, and everything else. All of that had to do with the teaching of John Africa to keep me aware of where that revolutionary road was headed to and the danger of stepping off of it. If it had not been for John Africa, I would have deteriorated like so many other prisoners that's in that system into all kinds of perversion, all kinds of criminality within the prison system. That's what has kept me and every MOVE member going. And that's what the system feared the most. The system viciously murdered our children. It tortured our women. I can remember Janet and Lee Singh being arrested. They were going to the store, and the police arrested them under prostitution law. I said, what the hell? This just shows the viciousness of the system. The police laughed when I went to the police district to see about them. They laughed, yeah, we got them. These two women were going to the store. Rhonda Africa got into a court situation, and she was 8 months pregnant. A scuffle broke out, and her baby was born bruised. This was terror that we had to fight. It only was able to survive it by what Don Africa did. Look at the murder of 11 Wu people, May 13th, 1985. That was horrible. Hmm.
We're going to hear much more from Delbert Africa when he comes into New York and gets the greeting from the beloved community that he deserves on March 14th, a people's victory celebrating the release of the Move 9. We're going to welcome home Delbert Africa to New York City. Delbert, I'm amazed when I speak to you that you haven't missed a step. You're back out in the community. You're organizing, you're mobilizing, you're agitating for people's empowerment. The philosophy of John Africa, what is that that has kept you so immersed even after 42 years when they tried to destroy your spirit, but they seem to have done nothing other than strengthened and fortified you?
The teaching of John Africa welded together a family of strong, serious, deeply committed revolutionaries that are dedicated to eliminating the oppression on all of life, human life, animal life, bird life, the water life. Because of that strong commitment, it keeps us together. Instead of pointing the finger of revolution at you, I point it at myself and say, follow this example. And this is what John Africa has taught us. And this is what keeps us going. Because we believe in natural law. We believe in self-defense. Self-defense is defending the planet. A baby has self-defense. That's natural. And with the viciousness of this system, that they will take water from it, pollute it, and then try to sell it back to us as good old spring water, and it came out somebody's pipe. You know, that's vicious. Only to find out that communities in a whole are polluted with lead-infested water. So all of these that type of examples, it is our duty to fight these politicians who get up there and politic lies. That's all it is, a bunch of lies. John Africa has taught us, you got to lead yourself, be senator of yourself, be governor of yourself. That's what we follow, and we try to set that example for other people to see, yeah, that's working. And that's where we coming from.
A siege.
We give all praises to John Africa.
Bomb, 48 dogs. The black commune that would not surrender, the heroic Delbert Africa. Welcome home, brother. I know that you will educate, agitate, and organize for the beloved community because a better world is possible, and your sacrifices and your ongoing work will continue to make it so. We want to thank you so much for being our guest, along with Brad Thompson, who's doing yeoman work as the people's lawyer. And Brad, we're going to also have you back to talk about the struggles to bring home Mutulu Shakur, another one of our valued and beloved political prisoners. Thank you for all the work that you both do.
Thank you. Thank you for having us, Mimi.
This has been Building Bridges, your community and labor report with Mimi Rosenberg
and Ken Nash. And log on to our website at www.buildingbridgesradio.org.